Welcome to the Abstract Veterans Podcast. Today, Dr. Char Gatlin and Kevin Sickinger speak with Sarah Carter and Jessica LaCroix. For more information, please visit limbic-cenc.org. Visit the Abstract Athlete for information and news. The Abstract Veterans Podcast with Char Gatlin and Kevin Sickinger.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to yet another episode of the Abstract Veteran Series. My name is Dr. Char Gatlin, and my co-host, Lieutenant Colonel retired Kevin Sickinger, got it right this time with the right rank, not lieutenant like last time.
I appreciate that.
Yep, no problem. I've been working hard on that one. So as we progress down season three, which our topic, ladies and gentlemen out there, is health and wellness, as you well know by now, I ran across these two dynamic young researchers when I was down at the MHSRS this year in Orlando. I'd like to introduce Drs. Sarah Carter and Jessa LaCroix. Did I get that right? Okay, just want to make sure. In speaking with these two young ladies, it became very apparent that their work, that they do their research, falls squarely under our health and wellness series. So I don't want to say any more because, I mean, this is going to be really interesting, I think, a great conversation, and should have some impact for our listeners and actually open up some really interesting avenues of discussion. So with that, Sarah and Jessa, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about yourselves, what got you kind of involved, who you're with, and we'll go from there.
Sarah, do you want to kick us off?
Thanks. So I'm Sarah Carter. I am with the Uniformed Services University, specifically the Suicide CPR Initiative. And my research has been really focused on military service members and veterans and looking at a range of issues, but specifically within romantic relationships and interpersonal relationships and how that influences kind of all realms of life that people experience. Jessa?
Yeah, sounds good. So I'm Jessa LaCroix. I'm a social psychologist, and I have been working at the Uniformed Services University since 2015. And as Sarah said, I'm actually the deputy director of the Suicide Care Prevention and Research Initiative. And similar to Sarah, my work focuses on military communities, primarily active duty, reserve guard, sometimes working with veterans as well. But I look at some of those more upstream factors for suicide prevention, as well as sort of improving overall quality of life, mental fitness for service members and their families.
I'm glad you spelled out what the CPR stood for. That was going to ask that question. So I'm glad you headed that one off at the pass for us. One of the things that struck me, Sarah, when you were talking about what you do, because one of our researchers within Limbic Sensei is doing a lot of work on domestic or partner violence. And that seems to be one of the issues. It's partner violence in correlation with TBI, obviously, because everything we do has to have some correlation to TBI. So what is it, what are you guys seeing? What is the trend when dealing with suicide, partner violence issues? We've all heard the 22 a day. We've all heard the stats thrown at us. But what is it that you two see from your foxhole, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the most consistent findings in the suicide research world is the impact that romantic relationships play. When relationships end, when they are having problems, whether that be violence related or just problems in general, that it is it's just such a common catalyst for people thinking about or actually attempting or dying by suicide. As it relates to domestic violence, one of the things that we found is actually that perpetration of domestic violence is associated with suicide risk, more so than being a victim. But the reality that we know from kind of the relationship realm is that it's actually the most common that someone is both the victim and the perpetrator, that episodes of domestic violence, unfortunately, often involve both members of a couple doing any kind of level of abusive sorts of things. And I'm a very big fan of trying to intervene upstream. So before things are turning to violence or when they're in the beginning days, and just helping couples to communicate in the best way possible, to help to learn different strategies to avoid those. I think it it has a robust research out there showing that it helps to reduce episodes of intimate partner violence. But some of my work is also focused on how we can harness that to reduce suicide as well, since we know that there's that connection.
You know, you mentioned the term interview upstream, and I think, you know, that there's a lot more to that that we could unpack. I mean, we could be here all day doing that for sure. You know, but I can remember times where, you know, when I was as a new officer, you know, and even, you know, I had, you know, NCOs coming in, and the deployment cycle, I mean, the operational pace was, gee whiz, man. I mean, you're there 12:15, it's during search spec, you come back, you're down maybe a month if you're lucky. And then you're standing back up, you're training back up, you're going back, right? And I'm not going to get into the reasoning for all that, you know, it's a little bit about how I pay above my pay grade. But the one thing that I saw, and I saw a lot of my peers, you know, you come back and we got problems. You know, I've got problems at home, but as a leader, I didn't really have time for my problems. I had to deal with everyone else's problems, you know, and it was frustrating, and it took its toll. And it never, you know, it never materialized into, you know, luckily, thank goodness, you know, the interpersonal contact that you described, but I know a lot of cases where it did. And it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, both parties. I'm not taking one side or the other here, but just the stress that builds up. And then I come home and I want to unload. And the next time my phone rings and I've got to go deal with A, B, and C, and some of the stuff I'm not gonna describe. But it really takes its toll. In your research, you know, have you not really have you looked at that per se, but looking at sort of the upstream interventions that you do, you know, taking into account the operational tempo and the fact that, you know, I have a job and I'm getting paid and I've got a commander, I've got an answer to, you know, how do I take care of myself? Mm-hmm. I mean, have you looked at that? Any ideas? Or anyway, I'm just throwing it out there. Run with it as you see fit.
I can take this one, Sarah. So what you're describing to me sounds an awful lot like a program that we had worked with Special Operations Command to develop for their SOF members and spouses. Called Special Operations Cognitive Agility Training. And one of the inflection points that comes up over and over as we were developing that training was this period of reintegration post-deployment, where I think a lot of people expect it to be, you know, a honeymoon, great, you're back, we've missed you, you missed us, come right back into, you know, the home and our life. And rarely does it go smoothly. Because the service members have had their own experiences and their own changes and growth and development while deployed. And then the family has also changed and has experienced and has developed during the deployment as well. So you're not necessarily coming back to the same thing that you left. And those differences in expectations can put a lot of stress on the relationship and the family. And I do remember one soft spouse describing how when her husband would come home after her deployment, how frustrating it was that she had to share her bathroom again, right? Because she just got, you know, 6 or 9 months of just having her own bathroom and everything is hers. And like now his stuff is everywhere and she's tripping over his boots and, you know, just how that's very different in like the day-to-day experience and how those little stressors, those little changes can add up to create a lot of stress within the couple. And so as Sarah mentioned, like trying to get ahead of it a little bit, trying to help people with that emotion regulation, being flexible in their expectations when they come home can be helpful, at least as sort of like a first line of approach to try to mitigate some of that risk. Sarah, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I think just to build off of that, in just talking with military and veteran couples over the years, one of the common experiences for couples where you've got one person that's in the military, one person that's a civilian, is that that struggle that you talked about often kind of rolls downhill, or rather maybe rolls uphill, but all of these kind of problems that people are experiencing might all coalesce and weigh on the command, on supervisors, on those that are trying to help and to corral everything going on. And then the partner that's at home often then is left holding all of the pieces of making life happen, of dealing with kids, of getting everything ready for a PCS, of just getting the food in the refrigerator, and then often face the same struggle of not having time to do the things for themselves or for the relationship. And I wish that there was an easy answer. I mean, I think the simple to say and really difficult to do is that it requires making this taking care of yourself and your relationship a priority. But it's such a tough thing to do when it doesn't have a deadline or someone that's going to yell at you if it doesn't go well, like many other things that we have in our lives.
You know, and I've been out for several years, but it resonates. You know, when you use, you know, you're talking about operations, you know, 6 and 9, but, you know, look at conventional forces, 12, 15, and 18 in some cases, you know, where you're really pushing that. And I mean, the training is a little bit different between operations and conventional, but the time commitment, and it's had 6 of 1, half a dozen the other, you know, for lack of a better term, but coming back, you know, and what you pointed out, and everybody's dealing with it. You know, I mean, you've got it at home, but then, you know, you're having to go into the unit and deal with it, and your boss is dealing with it, and their boss is dealing with it. And the Army, the Army's changed a lot for sure. And they're actually addressing this now, which needs to happen. But, you know, for the longest time, you know, I just I'll turn it over to Kevin. I think he's got a question right here. But I remember I was asked the other day to speak to some cadets, actually, or a couple of us were older. Now, I think I was the kid at the kids table of the officers that were there. But the you know, one of the things I told these young cadets, and I'm saying this, and I'm being forward with it. Now, you know, I'm just putting it out there. As I said, listen, folks, you know, how many of you have a significant other? You know, a couple of hands went up. Like, how many of you thinking about getting married right now? A couple of hands went up. And I said, you know, coming from someone that's been around for more than a day, you know, experience it first. Go see the Army, see what it's about. Because the Army is going to be your mistress, it's going to be your lover, it's going to be your friends. You know, it's the Army. You know, I think these are all good cadets. I mean, they're going to probably make great officers, but I think sometimes that sort of way of looking at things and that advice maybe sometimes gets lost in translation. And this is what you guys are saying is great to hear. So, what you got, Kevin?
To dovetail off of what Sarah was talking about, because it reminded me of last season. Last season we were doing a lot of caregiver issues, and one of the things that strikes my brain every time I think about it is self-care. And so it's hard to be a good caregiver if you're not taking care of yourself. And I think what Sarah was just talking about, it's hard to be in a good relationship with somebody else if you're not in a good relationship with yourself. Mm-hmm. And so what can we look at, what can we talk about in the field of taking care of oneself that y'all are dealing with a lot?
I'm Sarah, do you want to go? You want me to go first?
Perfect. Go for it.
Okay. So one of the things that we do try to address, at least with certain groups of people that we work with, so for example, military chaplains are coming to mind, is sort of like preventing that professional burnout or preventing compassion fatigue. And the way to do that is through self-care. And so one of the things that we work with our chaplain learners on is, you know, prioritizing that self-care to the best that they can, trying to work in like micro moments throughout that day, right? Because I would love to, you know, take myself on a vacation for a week. Is that really practical in my day-to-day life with my work and my family? Maybe not. But what can I do for 5 minutes here and there to make sure that I have that time to myself, that time for reflection, or that I'm doing activities that I enjoy? So intentionally doing activities that I enjoy. And one of the things that we also encourage our chaplains to do and our service members to do and our family members to do is to connect with other people, right? And I think it's so easy, especially now as we're sitting here doing this remote podcast, to not connect with other people or to see it as impractical or too time consuming, or you don't want to, you know, leave the house, you don't want to drive, you don't want to put on your nice clothes, whatever the reason is. but really promoting that connection. And so within our chaplains, I don't know, you all may know this, but chaplains are usually pretty isolated. You know, you might have a couple right? Like they take care of a lot of people and they usually do it alone or with their chaplain assistant or their RP or, you know, depending on your branch of service. So we encourage our chaplains to make friends with other chaplains, you know, reach out, talk to each other, have monthly phone calls. And similar to some of our other programs that we've developed as well. Char, I think the one that you had seen at MHSRS that we were talking about is MILI transition. So for those service members who are found unfit for duty after medical and physical evaluation boards, the first thing that we try to do is connect them with a veteran who's already gone through it. Because the primary aim for our program MILI transition is connection, connecting with somebody else, because that gives you an outlet, somebody to talk with, and you know, somebody to cope with. And also in the case of our veteran peer support specialists, a role model of how to do it, how to cope. Right. And so I think that by integrating sort of self-care into your day-to-day life, and then finding those opportunities for connection, you can kind of improve the overall health and wellness of yourself and then hopefully your partner, your family, and, you know, your Army.
You know, you mentioned, you know, involuntary separation. I want to dig into that in just a minute. But the comment, or just one comment before I go that way, is that, you know, the chaplaincy, you know, to me, and I know a lot of people used to laugh at this, but to me, they're frontline psychologists. Because people are coming to the chaplain. You know, the chaplain's down there, he's walking with the folks, you know, he's up on the line. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, misinterpret exactly what they do. They typically get it's the spiritual component. But the chaplain also is helping, he's passing messages. It's a backdoor approach a lot of times. You know, they listen. I remember mine, I used to play chess with every now and then. You know, it was a great way to kill some time. You know, and they love their books. They love their books, but I think it's brilliant actually integrating them more, because a lot of times, at least in my experience, and Kevin may have seen his own, but they, you know, they're left over to the side, you know, and chaplains are down at the unit level, and you have to integrate them a lot of times, which actually kind of dovetails into to the separation component, because the chaplain's probably the first one a lot of times to see, you know, some of the problems, or be able to, you know, to pass them along, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, one of the things that you sort of mentioned, you know, let me back up here, that sort of leads into this, is you get into this cycle of consistency. You know, it may not be healthy, but it's a cycle of consistency. And then all of a sudden, the big Army, or excuse me, the DOD steps in and says, hey, guess what? Boom. You know, you're out. Now, it could be for a myriad of reasons. You know, it could be health, it could be psychological, it could be behavior, it could be a lot of different reasons. You know, I had a friend who's his wife, you know, excellent officer, unfortunately got a call one day and their complete world just stopped, you know, and they didn't, and they're still dealing with it. They don't know what to do, but I guess what I'm getting at, just to give you a little, or put out background for some folks, is the, you know, the separation. Tell us a little bit about that. And yeah. Then, and you hit upon it a little bit, so your plans of action, but just define it, what it's about, and kind of, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, I mean, as you all know, and as your listenership probably knows, there are lots of ways to be separated from the service, some good, some not so good, some ambiguous, right? The one that I'm most familiar with in the context of our work is that medical separation. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to tell whether the voluntariness of it. Sometimes people are looking forward to being medically separated. They're done. They've, you know, done their time. They now are managing different conditions and they're ready to get out and do something else with their lives. And sometimes not, right? Sometimes it's seen as a slap in the face or a stab in the back where, you know, you've given the military the best years of your life and you've worked hard and you've, you know, done everything that you're supposed to do. And then you're being told that you're unfit, right? So, I mean, you know, if I were to, you know, lose my job, I don't think that I would lose it in the phrase of, sorry, Jessa, but you're unfit for this position or unfit for duty. That's kind of a slap in the face. So I think that there's a lot that goes into shifting life styles, right? From being in the service to being out of the service. But I think that the way in which that transition occurs and whether or not it's perceived as positive or negative, or even, you know, ambiguous, really impacts the person making that transition. I was going to share with you something else that I just had linked. Where is it?
Well, while you see if you can find that, Jess, so one of the things that I can expand on that I think that regardless of whether it's on paper or in actuality, a voluntary or involuntary separation, one of the things that I've heard consistently is the uncertainty of the process is still just incredibly stressful for folks going through that. Even if they're looking forward and wanting to get out, there's just this very long, often almost purgatory that people go into where they don't know what's going to happen when. They know they need to get a job, but when? They know that they might be moving, but when? And it's just this massive standstill, and they know that almost every aspect of their life is going to change, but when and in what way? They don't know. And so I think it's just, even under the best of circumstances where everybody agrees that this is the best step forward, the process is an incredibly stressful, a stressful one to go through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had a very close friend who was going through this process, which is sort of the inspiration for our Mili transition program. And he both wanted in and wanted out at the same time, depending on the day. Right. And so it was, if he started getting news that indicated that he was going to be, you know, separated, then he would start getting excited about it. Good. This is the best thing that I need. This is what I want. I'm going to get out. I'm going to do these things. And then if he started getting news that he was potentially going to stay, well, that was now at odds with what he was planning. Right. He's talking himself into it, getting excited about it. That's not happening now. So like constantly readjusting your expectations, and whether or not you're excited about going, excited about staying, like, you know, you kind of want to pick a route, and then you want to be like, oh, the grapes are sour over on that side, right? But then you get pushed back over to the sour grape side, and so you've got to kind of navigate back and forth. The other thing I was going to mention is Char, you made me think about this when you were talking about you know, your experiences and how even when you're home, you're still working, and military service is a 24-hour day job. Right. So I think a lot of us, you know, we work our 8 hours a day, or we do our 40 hours a week, and we go home, we have a line, you know, like, I'm now with my family and my work's not going to call me. I know it's nice. I do recommend it, but that change is enormous, right? So moving from losing an 8 hour a day position to picking up another 8 hour a day position is one type of transition. Changing a life, right? A 24-hour a day, like always on call, always with the mission in mind, ready to go at any moment, to not having that is vastly different than it is in the civilian world. It's not just loss of a job, it's loss of an identity, a sense of purpose, a community, consistency, predictability, a career. And it's something that I think that, you know, Sarah and myself being civilians, like, just can't comprehend.
And I'm going to add to that, I'm going to put a plus sign, a spouse and two children. I mean, it goes a lot deeper.
Yeah, I have a comment, then I don't even know if I can form it into a question, but we were talking about the involuntary, even the voluntary getting out of the military. Even, you know, mine was a retirement. And it was difficult because you basically had to drop your retirement paperwork 12 months in advance. And so you can't really predict where you can get employed 12 months from now. Nobody wants to interview you 12 months in advance. But so it's a leap of faith that you have to take. And it's not just your leap of faith, just like Char said. It was my wife, three kids and a grandkid, two dogs and a cat. We're all affected by this one choice I was going to make. And that was voluntary. So I can only imagine how difficult it is when it's involuntary. The question I'll try to form it. And we've mentioned it numerous times, whether it's connections or camaraderie or what is. So I was lucky because I kind of deprogrammed from the military in a very slow motion process. I went to professor of military science at University of North Dakota, which is up in the tundra. And so as professor of military science, we really didn't have many connections or camaraderie because everybody worked for us at that location. So we didn't have any peers. Our only peers were at other universities. So when we got together for functions, then all the lieutenant colonels acted like kids because it was the first time we had peers. So that was a 4-year slow transition from come from Afghanistan to North Dakota, which is obviously different, and a total change of pace, but still doing about 60 to 80 hours a week. And then when I retired, I went to junior ROTC at the high school I graduated from. So still wearing a uniform, still kind of doing military things, but with high school kids. And so that was 5 years. And then fortunately, I fell into working at VCU with Dr. Sifu, getting to work with veterans. So there was that feeling of need, feeling of accomplishment, still dealing with people that I love. So I had the most fortunate fall from career, in a nice slow motion nine-year project. Not that many people are afforded that. And what is there out there? Because that's one of the things we always see. Oh, well, there's a website, there's a web page, there's a whatever. Where do they go to? Who do they see for help? Who do they see for? We have the transition unit, we have the transition people, but it's so many things. It's information overload in a very hectic emotional time. How can you wrap that up in a couple minute answer?
Yeah.
Actually, not even a question. That was more of a statement.
Good. I'm glad you didn't want Sarah and I to provide you with a couple minute answer for that problem.
Yeah. But I mean, that's you guys are dealing or helping to deal with that problem. What is, and that then leads to the other things that you two are dealing with, because that just further compounds those issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think, you all may be familiar, Char, maybe you saw him, Joe Girasi. Dr. Joe Girasi is a retired Army colonel.
He was the lieutenant infantry colonel. Yes, I remember. He had a very interesting presentation, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So he's been after this issue for a long time. The issue being the transition out, whether voluntary or involuntary, and what happens and where do you go and who catches you, right, when you're going through that process. And he draws a parallel to when you PCS, right? When you PCS, you go to a new location, somebody's there to greet you, welcome to this location, you know, here are the good schools, here's the good grocery stores, this is where, you know, you'll want to go for fun, here's a community, here's, you know, other military families, we have kids the same age, like you kind of get kind of plugged in, and you get plugged in certainly to your new unit and your command, etc. And so you're plugged in when you PCS. Now, when you transition out of the service, you're not plugged in anywhere. Right, unless you're going to go do your own plugging, I guess. And so what Joe's team has really been focused on is this expiration term of service program, where they identify soldiers who are transitioning out of the Army, and they identify where their hometown is. So say they're leaving, Fort Carvazos now, right? They're leaving Fort Carvazos and their home is in New York City, and they're going back to New York City after they transition out. Well, Joe's team will find a veteran in New York City who's already there and established, and will connect the soldier transitioning out with somebody on the ground there in New York City, so that they kind of have that warm welcome to the community. And they have a lot of sponsors, like Starbucks is one of them. Like, they give them lots of gift cards and stuff, so that they have Starbucks as like a meeting location where it's, you know, a neutral ground. You can just go meet your sort of veteran sponsor who's going to help you get integrated within the community when you move back. So I think there are programs like that. Red, White, and Blue comes to mind as well. There's an app.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Yeah. So they do a lot in terms of that, just kind of trying to connect people. But I mean, these are informal things. These are community-based things, and they certainly have their pros and cons. There's a lot of idiosyncrasies between the program, but I think the ultimate goal is just trying to reconnect, right, and build.
And to underscore that, I think Jessa highlighted some really wonderful programs, and I think, you know, programs often come and go, or they might be, you know, she highlighted one that was great for the Army, but you know, what that might look like for somebody else. I think what comes to my mind is an overarching goal is just to not do it alone, to get connected, whatever that might look like, and whatever those needs might be, whether that's someone that'll help to get connected to the VA system who's done it, whether it's just someone that was a, you know, a buddy from the unit that went through a retirement a couple of years before, is finding folks to connect with, ideally that have gone through similar things, so that you're not just getting surprised out of left field with things, but that you've got someone that can maybe give you warning, or at least can be there to empathize when, you know, things get postponed, you know, another X amount of time, or, you know, it's taken forever to get that disability rating and, you know, what money that's going to come, whatever it is, just someone that can offer that empathy and that understanding is, I think, just getting connected by whatever means necessary to others is such a critical part of surviving that transition and to hopefully do so and work towards thriving.
No, it is. And there's no, I mean, I remember when I got out and I got dropped back down into lower Alabama and I'm looking around, like, nobody got it. You know, I didn't really talk to them, and I'm not going to get it and go back to graduate school. They really didn't get it. You know, but one of the things that I saw, keep in mind, I've been out a long time. I mean, it's been, but one of the things, the two things that I saw back then, and I'm being honest, and I'm not trying to step on some old toes on this one, was that a lot of the military professional or the medical professionals in the military at the time were either direct commission coming in or they were using civilian assets. And a lot of them didn't understand the military. So whatever people were telling them, they just didn't understand. Some of them did, not all of them, but a lot of them maybe didn't understand the concept, the camaraderie, the stress levels, and just some of the excuse my language, like the BS clowns floating around there, because there were quite a few of them. But I can remember that they were they used to be mandatory. It wasn't mandatory. Maybe that was the problem. But they had and it kind of goes what Kevin was saying a little bit earlier about not knowing where you're going to be or how you're going to be employed. But they had certain classes you had to take, like these. And I can't remember what they were called, Kevin. Maybe you remember. It wasn't fast classes, but you had these exit courses, you know, and like resume writing, you know, and some of them were medical. They were incorporated into the, you know, the getting out process, if you will. And I don't know if they were necessarily part of the MEB as well, or just, you know, someone whose time came up and went back. But, you know, there was a leg up, but I saw a lot of soldiers, service members, and I was Army, obviously, that just, they were angry, you know, like, we're getting out after 15 months of this noise, we're going back to Fort Living Room. And then I think some of them would get there and, kind of like my case, not know how to, you know, to adjust, you know, luckily, you know, forced socialization is kind of what did it for me, but a lot of folks may not be in that, that position or have the tools or maybe the experience, you know, that keeps them down. Man, we could go on and on with this stuff. Actually, I'm thinking about reaching out to hire and see if we can schedule a part two with you two. I mean, we can go, there's a lot of ground to cover here, but we're kind of hitting our time. Kevin, you got any more thoughts on this? Definitely the part two thing. I'm really thinking about that. We'll see.
I'm always full of thoughts. That's kids and wife really love the
fact that I'm full of thoughts, just not many actions. But that was reminding me of the 1 week. So I was in cadet command as I was transitioning out. You thought they would have had a perfect policy for it because 90% of the military members in cadet command end up retiring from cadet command, but they didn't really have a program, and so I'm stuck in Grand Forks, North Dakota, beside an Air Force base, so I can't transition there. So I had to I end up picking my own transition place. So I went back to Fort Knox just for the hell of it, because that's where I came into the Army. I'm like, I'll just make it the circle of life, and that's where I'll leave the Army. But it was the weird class, and you're in there from Spec 4 to full bird colonel. It's like the experiences aren't quite the same, but we made it, and we ended up transitioning, and we ended up getting out, and we fumbled our way through it. Just like pretty much the Army is good at fumbling its way through things just by brute force and tenacity and stick-to-itiveness. And so that's kind of how we mostly transition out. It's the way we do it. We try to make it as smooth as possible. We try to make it as efficient as possible. Some people's are smoother and more efficient, and some aren't. And we try to, you know, try to put that safety net to catch all the ones that kind of fall through the cracks. But You know, I greatly appreciate what y'all are doing and everything that y'all do for service members.
Yeah, it's been interesting. But before we leave, any closing thoughts or anything you two like to put out there? And I'm definitely serious about this part two thing here. We're gonna talk to Hiram. I think this was fun, actually. I told you it'd be a good time. Yeah, we just scraped the surface too.
Nice to see you all. I think the one thing that I would put a plug in for, and maybe this is part two, is we're talking a lot about veterans helping other veterans, right? And I think that there's a lot to be done in educating civilians in a community about how to support our veterans. Because I do think that happy, healthy veterans make happy, healthy communities, and you cannot have a healthy community without a healthy veteran population. So a lot of work needs to be done there for us, like you said, Char, to try to mitigate the BS clowns. We want to have, you know, people who are ready to receive, right? Like after everything that our veterans have done for us, we want to be able to pay it back. And I don't think that we've got clear guidelines in the civilian world of how to do that.
That's an excellent point, and actually a great part too. Sarah?
No, I mean, Jessa said it better than I could. I think there are so many opportunities and more importantly, needs. And it's exciting that there are a lot of people that are trying, and there's still so much to do, and a great thing to unpack in a part two.
Yeah, you're lining up for me. I mean, this is too easy right here. See, I don't, yeah, this is good stuff. Well, hey, I'm getting tapped again, too. We're going to go way over time. But hey, you know what? I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd like to thank you, too, for being on here, for sure, for taking the time to come entertain us and to hopefully, you know, impart some knowledge to our listenership out there, you know, about the process. And the, unfortunately, you get picked up one day and you get dropped off somewhere else like Lower Alabama. And, you know, it's just a whole different ballgame, 48 hour whirlwind, and you're somewhere else and having to start over again. But thank you again, and keep up the good work. Sarah, Jess, I mean, it's good to see you again. It's nice to reconnect, and it sounds like you guys are really getting it done out there. So with that, I think we've come to the conclusion of yet another episode of the Veterans Abstract Series. Thank you for tuning in. Really appreciate it. And as always, thanks to the team that remains unseen and Ron up top in the box for getting it done. And we look forward to seeing you next episode. Stay safe and hang in there. Goodbye.
Thank you to Sarah Carter and Jessica LaCroix for joining Dr. Char Gatlin and Kevin Sickinger today on the Abstract Veterans Podcast. For more information, please visit limbic-cenc.org. The Abstract Veterans, produced by The Abstract Athlete. For more information, please visit theabstractathlete.com. And as always, follow us on all of our social media platforms under The Abstract Veterans, The Abstract Doctors, and The Abstract Athlete. See you soon with our next episode.